Good morning, everyone. We are going to start with a hearing on climate change and access to water and human rights. Unfortunately, we only have 45 minutes for this hearing, so I will not take any more time. I will simply ask those who are representing the petitioners who requested the hearing to introduce themselves.
Thank you very much, members of the Commission. My name is Martin Wagner. I'm managing attorney of the International Program at Earth Justice. Today we will be discussing the relationship between climate change, access to fresh water, and human rights, an important topic and one in which we believe the Commission can play an important role. For that reason, we are very grateful to the Commission for agreeing to hold this hearing. As you know, access to fresh water is already a serious problem in the Americas. Over 22 million people live in watersheds that do not supply the 1,000 cubic meters of water per year per person that the UN Food and Agriculture Organization considers the minimum for meeting basic human needs. As we will hear today, rising temperature and changing precipitation are exacerbating these problems and are likely to continue to make them worse in coming decades. These problems are not theoretical. They are affecting people and communities around the hemisphere. Three presenters will discuss these issues today. Dr. Kevin Trenberth will discuss the current scientific consensus that human-caused climate change is contributing to water stress. Mr. Alivio Arequipa Lasso will describe the impact of water stress on his indigenous community in Capi, Bolivia. And finally, I will make a very brief presentation about the human rights implications of these issues, after which time we will have time to answer questions from members of the Commission. So first, Dr. Kevin Trenberth, who is the head of the Climate Analysis Section at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado, and chair of the Scientific Steering Group of the Global Energy and Water Cycle Experiment under the World Climate Research Program. He was coordinating lead author of the 2007 Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Assessment chapter on observations, surface and atmospheric climate change, and his research currently focuses on climate change and precipitation. Dr. Trenberth?
Thank you, Martin. Madam President, Commissioner, as Martin has said, I am a climate scientist, and I will go very quickly through the climate science. I will be happy to answer questions, and I'm afraid we have to skip over a lot of it. But I thought I would start with the global mean temperature record. This is a record from NOAA. I hope you can see the screen. And what I so there's an overall upward trend here, but what I have done here is to add the annual values estimated of carbon dioxide prior to 1957. These are from bubbles of air and ice cores. And I put these together to indicate that there is a relationship between them, and we believe we can prove that there is a relationship between them using climate models. So carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. It produces warming of the planet, actually heating of the planet. So global warming in that sense means global heating. Some of that heat goes to evaporating moisture, and it directly affects the hydrological cycle, the water cycle. When we look at changes in precipitation, we often only talk about the amount, but we need to consider many other aspects. Precipitation is inherently intermittent, and so we need to talk about the frequency, how often it occurs, the intensity, how hard, how heavy the rain is or the snow, the sequences, whether one storm occurs on top of another, and whether it's rain or snow. The intensity in the rain affect how much runs off, for instance, the flooding, and how much is left behind for the soils and agriculture. A general point that is important is that rain and snow for the most part, come from moisture which is converged in the atmosphere by the weather system that is producing it, not directly from evaporation. It's not just the water going up and coming down, but rather coming in from the sides, which is why it only rains over about 7% of the globe at any time. And so the weather systems sweep up the moisture. As a result, if there's more moisture in the atmosphere, it rains harder or it snows harder. And with warming, the atmosphere can hold more water vapor. And we're seeing this happening. And as a result, this is one of the trends which is robust, that when it rains harder. But then there are longer dry spells in between. This map here shows the overall changes around the world where they're significant. The increases are generally in the higher latitudes throughout North America, Europe, and Asia, and in Argentina in the southern hemisphere. And then it's mainly in the tropics and throughout Africa, or the subtropics and throughout Africa, where there are decreases in precipitation occurring. In general, around the world where we can measure it, when it does rain, the observations show that it rains harder. When it rains, it pours. This graphic here shows the top 5% of the rains, the heavy rains, the very wet days. And you can see many parts of the world in Africa and also in South America, there's insufficient data to document this. But in general, there's more blue on this map indicating that when it does rain, it rains harder, and that's certainly true in North America where the data are best. But drought is also increasing. This relates to the longer dry spells. This is the dominant pattern of drought around the world, and the time series has an upward trend with a special jump in the early 1980s. So the upward trend corresponds to where the brownish, the warm colors are increasing in drought around the world. And that includes the Amazon, for instance. There's been substantial droughts last year and in 2005. But you'll notice Argentina has had a substantial increase in precipitation, and also much of the United States, especially east of the Rockies and parts of Northern Europe. But other places around the world, drought is generally increasing. Part of this is because of the changes in rainfall patterns, but a big part of it is because the atmosphere is warmer. It sucks more moisture out of the soils, there's more evaporation, and so when you do have a dry spell, the dry spell is more intense. The drought sets in earlier and lasts longer. An important factor throughout the Americas is the mountains and glaciers around the world are generally retreating. In particular, they're retreating in the tropical Andes, where the glaciers form an important source of water for a number of purposes. And this graphic shows a number of glaciers in Ecuador, Peru, and Bolivia. If we look at a transect across the Americas from north to south or from south to north, as given on the left panel here, and look at the change that is predicted by the climate models, we see that there is an increasing, larger temperature increases are expected as we go higher in altitudes. And that's especially true in mountain areas because of the effects in snow and ice. As snow and ice melt, it replaces a bright surface that reflects the sun with a dark surface that absorbs the sun, and so the ice melts even more. So the prospects are not good. But glaciers, this is just a brief graphic showing the importance of the glacial water and in general, water in the mountains for a number of countries in the Americas, hydropower generation, the water for urban areas and various ecosystems, and also for agriculture. This is just one graphic. In the handout, there are a number of other examples, but it shows a timeline from 1940, 1982, and so on, in one site, one glacier in Bolivia. And then the latest I have here is in 2009, and the glacier is largely gone. And the next speaker will address some of the impacts of the changes in Bolivia. The model projections for precipitation as a whole for the latter part of the 21st century are shown here. The pattern is on the left, and it matches to a large degree what we're already seeing signs of, that it gets drier in the subtropics in particular, and the places where it's already wet in the monsoon belt, and at higher latitudes where the main storms track, there are increases. And so this is referred to often as the rich get rich and the poor get poorer, or really the wet get wetter and the dry get drier. And on the right panel here is the projected changes in soil moisture, which do not especially reflect the changes in precipitation because of the increased evaporation in particular and the changes in the intensity of moisture, which runs off more, so it's not available for use in agriculture or for irrigation purposes. And so more dry spells are on the cards just about everywhere. And so this slide here is sort of the summary slide, which goes over a few points that I've skipped a little bit. But, you know, climate change is happening. It's clearly due to humans. It changes temperature. It changes water vapor, which directly changes precipitation to be more intense with longer dry spells, a shorter snow season, and less snowpack, which turns out to be very important for the seasonal aspects, the timing of the runoff, and the amount of moisture that's available in the summer, the growing season, when it is most needed. So this pattern is that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, but the patterns are somewhat complex. There's greater risk of flooding, but also a greater risk of droughts, of course not at the same place, different places at different times. And we've seen that occurring already. The temperatures are rising, and the higher elevations are going to be affected even more, and glaciers are melting, and there will be some seasonal changes in water availability and in river flow. All regions are affected, some more than others, but some areas have more infrastructure to be able to deal with these kinds of things, and it's the poorer regions that are really impacted more than the so-called rich areas. But water management everywhere will be a major challenge in the future. And so I just close with this slide, which I happen to like because it puts a face on the world of climate change, and suggests also that we do have some tools where we can make predictions, observations, and modeling to contribute to what we're calling here environmental justice. Thank you, Madam President.
Thank you very much. I should explain the reason for the movement of the camera. This is webcast, so we're trying to make sure that every speaker actually gets their face attached to their presentation. So thank you.
Thank you, and thank you, Kevin. Obviously, Kevin was very brief in his description of the science, and if you have further questions either later today or at any other time, contact us and we can help you understand the science. But I think the bottom line point is that there is a clear scientific consensus that climate change is happening, that it is caused by human beings, and it is having serious effects on freshwater access in the Americas. And these effects have a very direct impact on human beings. And so our next speaker will give us just one example of these impacts in the Americas. Señor Alivio Arequipa is a farmer and a leader of the Bolivian community of Capi, and he is going to describe the impact of water stress on his indigenous community there.
Buenos días, señoras, señores. Mi nombre es Alivio Arequipa. Soy comunario de la central agraria Capi, que se encuentra a pies de nuestro glaciar Illimani. más o menos a 60 kilómetros de la ciudad de La Paz. Mi comunidad es Central Agraria y aglutina más o menos más de 30 comunidades. Nosotros somos pequeños agricultores. Nos dedicamos al cultivo de papa, cebada, arvejas, habas, maíz. Y con el aumento de temperatura estamos plantando también algunas plantitas como duraznos, manzanas. Y tenemos también un poco de ganado como vacas, ovejas y llamas. Estos 30 comunidades, más de 30 comunidades, usamos las aguas que se derriten de nuestro glaciar Illimani para regar nuestros cultivos, para cocinar nuestros alimentos, para asearnos y también para hacer beber a nuestros animales. Ahora en estos últimos 20 años nuestro glaciar se está derritiendo y nosotros estamos muy afligidos y creo que en los años posteriores ya no vamos a tener agua. Ya no vamos a tener agua para beber, ni para cocinar nuestros alimentos, ni para asearnos. Ya no vamos a tener agua ni para hacer beber a nuestros animales. Ya no vamos a tener agua ni para regar nuestros cultivos. Por eso que estamos muy preocupados porque por falta de agua todo puede acontecer, ¿no? Nosotros, por falta de agua, nuestra seguridad alimentaria también estaría en riesgo. Y también nuestra cultura, porque nosotros también tenemos nuestra propia cultura. Nosotros hablamos aymara, nuestra lengua materna es aymara, tenemos costumbres y tradiciones en la comunidad. Nosotros lo vemos a este glaciar como un ser vivo que nos ha dado agua. Y por eso nuestros antepasados tenían mucho respeto y vivían en armonía y respetaban todo lo que existe en este monte. Y cuando hacemos limpieza de acequias, nosotros le damos ofrendas para que este glaciar nos dé agua, más agua. Ahora, si este glaciar desaparece, entonces mucha gente va a tener que emigrar a otros lugares donde hay agua, inclusive a la ciudad, inclusive a otros países, en donde ellos se van a olvidar hasta inclusive de su idioma, de sus costumbres y tradiciones. No solamente eso, con el derritimiento de nuestro glaciar, también este derritimiento de nuestro glaciar ha causado porque nuestras vertientes están cada vez más anchas, y esto hace que haya deslizamiento de tierras, y así afectando a nuestros caminos carreteros, destrozando puentes y también afectando a nuestras acequias, ¿no? Y por otro lado, también en estos últimos años ha aparecido nuevas enfermedades en nuestros animales, como hay un gusano plano conocido como fasciola hepática que destroza el hígado de nuestros animales. Y cuando tiene el animal este gusano plano, entonces enflaquece y muere. En nuestros cultivos también han aparecido nuevas enfermedades, como en el papa, pasmo negro, en el maíz también, en el haba también aparecieron, ¿no? Y para comprar estos medicamentos, nosotros tenemos que trabajar doble. Nuestros productos llevamos a la ciudad a vender, y con ese dinero nosotros compramos estos medicamentos, porque estos medicamentos cuestan muy caro y mayormente vienen del extranjero. Y así nosotros sacrificamos hasta inclusive la comida de nuestros hijos. Nuestros hijos tienen pulmonía, tienen tuberculosis, anemia. Y por eso que nosotros necesitamos fondos para construir, para adaptarnos, ¿no? Y también para construir pequeñas represas, pequeños atajados para canalizar nuestras acequias y así mejorar el riego también, ¿no? Porque en estos últimos tiempos la lluvia no llueve en su tiempo. Está cada vez más seco, por eso nuestro glaciar está cada vez más derritiendo. Porque antiguamente la nieve caía, más o menos lo reponía nuestro glaciar como con 2 metros, pero ahora la nieve ya no cae, ya no llueve. Cuando llueve, calle torrencial, con vientos fuertes, con truenos, con granizos, y igualmente destroza nuestros cultivos. Hay años cuando no cosechamos ningún producto por causa de estos fenómenos naturales. Y también la lluvia llueve y al otro día está congelando. Igualmente destroza nuestros cultivos. Por eso nosotros estamos muy preocupados, porque la vida en el campo, en la montaña, se hace más difícil para nosotros. A veces nos preguntamos qué será de nuestros hijos, qué es lo que va a pasar. Y también estamos muy preocupados porque esta montaña es para nosotros es una represa natural que Dios nos ha bendecido. Y estamos muy preocupados, no sé qué es lo que va a pasar con nuestros hijos, qué es lo que van a comer, parece que ya no tenemos futuro. Gracias, señores, por haberme escuchado. Muchísimas gracias.
Thank you very much, Alivio. It is important to note that the situation that Alivio described is not unique. Many, many communities in the Americas are facing increased water stress that will likely be exacerbated by climate change. And it won't only be because of the loss of dry season water due to the reduction in glaciers and snowpack. Other communities are seeing their freshwater resources become salty as sea levels rise and the salty water intrudes into their freshwater. Or they're suffering from crop failure from drought, or infectious diseases from floods, or simply contamination of water supplies as a result of flooding. Before we move to letting you ask any questions you have, I want to take a moment to discuss why these matters are an issue of human rights and why this commission should be concerned about them. You don't need me to tell you about every human right that is affected by the climate by the changes we're describing. You know them far better than I, but I will mention only a few that are most particularly relevant. The right to water has been recognized by many human rights institutions, including the United Nations. And I'm going to go through these slides fairly quickly, but they are in the materials that we've provided you. The Inter-American Court has recognized the relationship between an adequate supply of fresh water and the right to a life of dignity. And this has been recognized as well by the United Nations General Assembly, which has recognized the right to safe and clean drinking water and sanitation, as well as a number of the bodies under the different UN human rights conventions. Other rights affected by the loss of access to fresh water include the right to life, the right to health and sanitation, the right of all peoples to their means of subsistence, and a number of rights related to indigenous and other resource-dependent peoples, including the benefits of culture, as Alivio described, the relationship of his culture to the glacier that provides their water, as well as the ability to use and enjoy the lands that they've traditionally used and occupied. It's also important to remember the connection here between these water impacts and climate change and the relationship between climate change and human rights, because it is the fact that human beings are causing climate change that makes this a human issue. This is not just natural change unaffected by human activity, but in fact it is a human impact. And so it's important to recognize the relationship between climate change and human rights. And as you probably know, the United Nations Human Rights Council has recognized that climate change has an impact on the enjoyment of human rights. The Office of the High Commissioner on Human Rights has recognized not only that global warming has implications for human rights, but that one of those implications is a relationship with the right to fresh water. So this is obviously a much too summary view of the relationship between the legal obligations and the changes in water access. We have in our request for this hearing provided more detail, and if you don't still have a copy of that, I can provide that later. But I want to suggest a few reasons why this commission should address this question. In light of the likelihood that climate change is going to seriously exacerbate water stress throughout the hemisphere, and because of the impact of that stress on numerous human rights, this commission has an opportunity to raise the profile of this issue, to highlight the need for governments to take serious action. So we would encourage the commission to formally recognize that climate change is a human rights issue, particularly in the context of water, and to call upon all governments to make special efforts to promote equitable access to fresh water and to take steps now to prepare for increased constraints on freshwater access. And then in addition, to call upon the governments that are most responsible for climate change, which in the Americas is primarily the United States and Canada, to make the greatest possible efforts to mitigate climate change, to minimize its impacts, and this includes through their national policies with respect to greenhouse gas emissions, as well as through serious participation and efforts to reach common agreement in the international climate negotiations, as well as to provide substantial assistance to the most vulnerable, least responsible governments as they address the climate-induced threats to human rights. I don't think this means that the Commission has to come up with a specific prescription for what each government has to do. I think it will carry great weight with the international community if this Commission, as an authoritative body interpreting human rights, will simply make the clear statement that climate change is an issue of human rights and that governments therefore have a responsibility to address it. Thank you very much, and we now have a few minutes to answer your questions.
Thank you. I have two questions to start with. First of all, to Dr. Trenberth. One of the problems that you are very familiar with, I know because my son lives in Boulder, is forest fires as a result of lack of precipitation. Are there statistics that have been done about increasing rates of fires as a consequence of the higher temperatures and the higher altitudes? So that's my first question is about, because that in turn also has consequences for food production, for migration, for all types of issues. My second question is to Martin. As you know, governments have divided responses to climate change into adaptation and mitigation. And when we start talking about rights, we look for corresponding obligations. And I'm wondering whether you said we shouldn't be prescribing detailed things about what each government should do, but it might be useful to give some general guidelines and efforts to establish accountability and legal responsibility have gone almost nowhere in climate change negotiations. So I'm wondering how we frame the obligations of governments internally as well as transboundary to respond to these issues, particularly important in the context of water, since nearly all large bodies of water have more than one state involved. They have riparians. So how do we address these issues? And before you answer, I'll ask if Commissioner Escobar, he also has some questions.
Yo quiero agradecer la información que se nos acaba de presentar. en relación con el cambio climático. Indudablemente es un tema muy complejo sobre el cual pudiera formular distintas preguntas, pero voy a formular solo una pregunta que más bien es de carácter general. Y la pregunta concreta que voy a formular es: ¿qué medidas o qué acciones pueden realizar los organismos internacionales de derechos humanos y concretamente la Comisión Interamericana para contribuir a la atenuación o a la disminución de las causas que producen el cambio climático? Hay un consenso de que el cambio climático es producto de la acción del hombre y fundamentalmente del uso de la energía que se basa en el petróleo y en el carbón, que además todos sabemos que los países más industrializados son los que se oponen a la adopción de medidas orientadas a disminuir esas causas. Y hoy en día el tema de la generación de la energía es de alta complejidad porque por el reciente terremoto en el Japón prácticamente va a colapsar a nivel global el uso de energía derivada de las plantas nucleares. Entonces, realmente es un problema de la mayor complejidad sobre la cual ha habido impotencia de parte de la comunidad internacional frente a los intereses del desarrollo económico y del crecimiento económico de los países altamente industrializados. Entonces, lo que yo quisiera preguntar es: ¿qué podemos hacer, por ejemplo, los organismos internacionales, la Comisión Interamericana, para contribuir y para instruir a los estados en relación con la necesidad de disminuir las causas que ocasionan el cambio climático? Gracias.
One last comment, Martin. You'll have to update your slide on the right to water to add the fact that the Commission did refer to it in a precautionary measure last year.
You asked about wildfires, and I'm perhaps not as familiar with all of the literature related to that, but the increased risk of drought and the increased risk of wildfire is indeed one of the consequences of the global warming aspects of climate change. And whether wildfires actually occur depend a lot on human actions and also the ability to manage forests by including things like fire breaks, cutting down on litter, risk, and so on. One of the difficulties with statistics on fires is that many occur through human actions, and there are more people around going to more places, and so it's not necessarily caused by the climate change aspects, but there are very clear links nonetheless between the increased risk, the drier conditions, and one of the comments that has been made, you know, it's already hot in, say, Arizona in the summertime. Why should I worry if it's a few degrees more? And, you know, maybe I've got air conditioning. But one of the real things that increases substantially with increased heat is the risk of wildfire. And we've seen a number of examples of that, I believe it has been documented in the literature.
I'm perhaps especially sensitive to that since I lost my house and all my belongings to a wildfire about 15 years ago. Martin.
Well, thank you both for your questions. So you have asked, I think, both of you a form of the same question, which is, what is it that the Commission can do, and what can the Commission expect reasonably governments to do in response? And it's a big topic, and it would be a conversation that we should have over a longer period of time, perhaps over beers or something. But let me touch on a few important points. I think the first is to say that it is quite a challenge to identify specifically, to attribute exactly the responsibility for a particular climate impact to a particular action of a government or a private actor. But the first thing, and I think this is maybe the most important point I want to make on this topic, is that that challenge should not prevent this commission from doing things that it can do that will have value. I think the commission has an opportunity to recognize its power with respect to international affairs and to create pressure for governments to take serious action. And I think one of the first ways that the commission can have an influence is on the ongoing international negotiations. As you know, governments have an obligation to cooperate in resolving human rights problems as well as other international issues, and the strength of human rights should be brought to bear on this problem to create additional incentive and pressure on governments to act to seriously be negotiating an international solution. And there are particular elements of the ongoing climate negotiations that touch on human rights and that this commission could participate in. I think it would be very interesting for the commission to designate a person to follow and participate in the ongoing negotiations. There are discussions currently about whether the final outcome of the climate negotiations will include a reference to the human rights implications of climate change. Just including that kind of reference could be a very powerful hook for this institution and other international human rights institutions to continue being involved in the ongoing development and implementation of an international climate regime. In addition, we know that a number of the measures that are being proposed for governments to address climate change, primarily through mitigation measures, have the potential themselves to cause human rights problems. And it would be very important for this commission, both by recognizing the importance of the connection between climate change and human rights, and even better, by actually being engaged in the negotiations, to help shape what are being called safeguards, different mechanisms that are being proposed to monitor and guarantee the enjoyment of human rights in the face of these potential response measures. So that's on the level of the international negotiations, and I think that's a step. There are things that the Commission could do without getting into the details of attribution. And then you ask the question about what do individual governments do and how do we address the question of transboundary harms and responsibilities. This is a problem that in the details gets very challenging. I think the Commission right now doesn't need to address that level of detail. That's a problem that might want to be addressed in a more specific situation. If there were a specific petition before the Commission, then you could address that question. I think that you need to call on governments to take action to address their contribution. It doesn't matter. You don't need to specify the level of their contribution in order to call on them to reduce their emissions. Obviously, the most responsible governments have a greater responsibility for taking action. In terms of transboundary impact, similarly, it's with respect to the contribution to climate change, it's their national emissions that are contributing to climate change. And so that's not a question of asking them to act in a transboundary manner. It's simply acting domestically. I do believe that they have transboundary obligations, and I think that you all are probably as aware as I that international human rights institutions have begun to recognize that human rights obligations do not end at national borders. And we have a body of international environmental law that can be used to understand the meaning of human rights obligations, and that body depends in large part on the principle that governments should not cause transboundary environmental harm. The same should be true when that environmental harm is related to human rights questions.
Thank you very much. And astonishingly, it is exactly 9:45 and 6 seconds, so congratulations for keeping to the 45 minutes that we had for this particular panel. And I look forward to seeing the contributions that you have left here for us and the details that are in the reports, and to making this an ongoing discussion, because this is not a problem that is going to go away over the coming year or decade even. So thank you very much.